a smoke shop versus the United States. Ms. Zerner.
Good morning. May it please the court, Bridget Zerner for the Smoke Shop LLC. When you strip this case of all the statutes and technicalities here, there are two things that are unarguable. First, the government took the smoke shop's property when it was legal, and two, that second, the property is worth about $110,000. The government had no legitimate basis for seizing that property and deeming it forfeited. The government thought that these were analog drugs in the incense products, but they were wrong, as the district court below found. But before the district court could grant the smoke shop's 41G motion and return the property, days before, actually, the DEA scheduled these products as controlled substances. They had already seized them and held them for several months before they deemed them illegal. This is a due process violation, and it's a great concern here. the government made a mistake, and they have to pay for it. And while the smoke shop first pursued a remedy under 41G, that process was foreclosed by the government by its intervening action of scheduling these drugs, so that there was no meaningful due process through the motion for return of property.
When they schedule the drugs, my understanding, at least from the briefs, is it's a two-year process and then that gets revisited. Is that right?
It is when they did a temporary scheduling, mm-hmm. that schedules the drugs for 2 years.
When's that 2 years lapse?
The exact date would be 2 years from May. It was May 2013.
So you still have 11 months to go before that happens. What's the end game there? Do you know? Happens if to the end of that 2 years they agree that this substance should not have been listed? Can you get your property back then?
I would doubt it. I assume because of the way the DEA has behaved so far that they were not going to return the property even if 11 months from now they deem it legal.
And can you make an administrative claim at that point then? If the end game plays out and if it's illegal, you'd agree that you're never getting it back, right?
Right.
And if the end of this two-year process they deem it illegal, I suppose you might have an administrative remedy, but let's say it never becomes legal again. You won't get it back. But let's say they were wrong, and at the end of the 2 years they decide they were wrong. Can you go to the administrative? Is there an administrative process for you to invoke at that point?
I think at that point, then perhaps the smoke shop could file another motion to return property or to seek damages again under this. Well, they'd be in the same place under the Torts Claim Act, mm-hmm. here, that the government would then claim the detention of goods exception again. I think even if the smoke shop was able to pursue a motion for a claim against the government at that point. But the reality is that that's not going to happen, and the Attorney General can move to extend the scheduling for another year after that if it deems it in the interest. And the way the DEA is moving on this, there's no indication that they would change their position on this and that there'd be any remedy for the smoke shop at that point.
And I guess that's my ultimate question in this case is, the government says that they initially took these substances to investigate them. Then at some point they listed them. And once they're listed, you don't get them back. And there's a process that goes through whether that listing is appropriate. And if at the end of the day you can get a full remedy through the administrative process and you just have to wait, but at the end of the day you either get the property back or if the property is no longer usable, I don't know what the shelf life of these products would be, but let's say it's no longer usable, you'd get some recompense. Then isn't this just a matter of waiting and getting your money ultimately?
I think,
or your property?
Right. Mm-hmm. Again, that would... You're saying then if at that point it was deemed illegal and they'd no longer scheduled the drugs, it would have to be through, again, a motion for return of property because under the Torts Claim Act, they wouldn't return the property that way. And again, they would claim the detention of goods exception. And because of the way this is going, again, that remedy is not a reality.
Okay. And I'm certainly going to ask the other side exactly those same questions because they may have a better grip on the answer to that by experience than you might. But I'm just curious to know whether you think at the end of the day, if it turns out these substances are not properly listed, would you have a full remedy? And the answer is not sure, not too confident about, though.
Right. And I think, on that point as well, from the indication in this case, the officer said at the beginning that even if the test results came back that these were not the analog drugs or other illicit drugs that they were sure that they were, that they were sending this product on to the FDA and they would not be returned at that point then. Of course, the FDA has its own regulations and a broader definition of what is a drug and a new drug, and all indications were this is never coming back. And as you described it, you said the government is arguing that they were investigating whether this was an illegal product. We think the record is clear that they were not just doing an investigation. They were certain that these products were analog drugs based on what they believe in the DEA. As they state in their letter, the DEA considers these analogs. And again, we're talking about UR-144 and XLR-11. At the moment that they seized them, Mr. Yarmo followed up in a few days to check on the status of this testing, as he understood it would be occurring within a couple weeks and locally, and he was certain he would get his product back because he had gotten the test results from manufacturers, believed there was no analogs or other illegal substances in there, and that is why he gave his conditional consent for them to test it. The government said didn't even have the test results yet and said, you're never getting these back. And the two reasons that this seizure was for the purpose of forfeiture was, one, because the government was certain this was contraband. And under 21 U.S.C. 881, contraband is immediately forfeitable. They certainly do not initiate a civil asset forfeiture process for drugs. So the fact that that didn't occur is not an indication that these were not seized for forfeiture.
But they weren't officially forfeitable until they listed them, right?
No. They would be forfeitable if they qualified as an analog drug under the Analog Act. And for that to be so, they would need to show that, one, they are substantially similar in chemical structure, these substances and in a scheduled drug. And that's where we had the battle at the evidentiary hearing, and we had all of our experts, most of the scientific community outside the DEA, has said that UR-144 and XLR-11 are not analogs to JWH-018, a scheduled drug. So if, though, these were analogs, at the moment they were seized, analogs are treated like controlled substances and are deemed forfeitable at that time.
But are they not alleged analogs until they actually listed them? Isn't that what made them analogs, is that they were actually put on a list?
No.
No, okay.
The listing makes them scheduled drugs. The Analog Act is aimed at these substances that arise that the government doesn't know about yet and cannot put on a list to say that they are scheduled. So substances that are not listed and scheduled can be legal if they qualify as an analog. And that's what did not occur here. These substances, by their chemical structure, were not substantially similar to a controlled substance to be properly deemed an analog drug. The government was wrong. They took these under that belief, they seized them, deemed them forfeited, and as they said, they were wrong and they should be held accountable for that now. The smoke shop went through the first process, and the DEA intervened by filing this notice when the evidence was clear, and the district court found that he would have granted the motion to return this property had it not been that in just the days before, they put them on the scheduled list. And as Judge Randa pointed out, that indicated to him that these were not analogs in the first instance. And he cited that it seems unfair. Then the small business owner then has to go on through further litigation, which he then did pursue.
How do you know, though, that they were deemed forfeited? Just because they told you were never going to get them back? Like, what's the official act that says, we've taken this property and it's now deemed forfeited? How do you know that?
Besides what they first said to Mr. Yarmo, and this happened on several occasions, he followed up himself, he followed up with counsel just a month later. That's when he withdrew his consent to the DEA and said, I want my property back. not only through those conversations, but certainly after the motion for the Rule 41G was filed in November, the government filed a response letter, and it's in the appendix. The DA's response letter, which was filed in December 14th, 2012, they said then in that letter that some test results had come back. They found that some of these products contained UR-144 and XLR-11, and that the DEA considers these to be controlled under the Analog Act. Therefore, they're contraband, and they will not be returned.
Okay, but they didn't know that until they ran the tests on them, right?
Officially, yes.
Okay, so the moment they took them, they didn't know that.
They didn't know that, but they believed that.
Okay.
It's all our indication, because they took these properties and they said, we're testing these. From their actions, it was clear to the smoke shop that they deemed these contraband and they were not going to give them back.
You're into your rebuttal time.
You want to save some time?
Actually, I would like to save some time. That was,
all right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Zenner. Mr. Krueger.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. My name is Matthew Krueger, appearing on behalf of the United States. Smoke Shop's claim for money damages cannot proceed for two separate reasons. First, the smoke shop never filed an administrative claim for money damages, let alone a claim that specified a sum certain, and that's an absolute bar to filing a suit under the FTCA. Second, even if they had filed a claim, the detained goods exception to the FTCA would bar their suit. And I'll address that first. As this court noted in on-site screenings, the detained goods exception is broad. It bars any claim arising out of the detention of goods by any law enforcement officer. Law enforcement officers frequently seize goods in the course of their investigative activities. They need to determine whether things are evidence, potentially contraband. This is core law enforcement activity, and that is what the detained goods exception shields from the chilling effects of tort suits.
So what is the end game, though? So the end game, let's say the end game is that after this two-year period, whoever the powers that be agree with the eight experts from the smoke shop that these don't belong as the substances that should be prohibited, and they're perfectly legal. Do they have a remedy then? Even if it's not a suit and damages, can they get their property back?
If that occurred, if in 2 years the DEA did not list them again or make them permanently listed, they would be within the DEA's possession. I can tell the court that the products are still within the DEA's possession now. And then the smoke shop could request the return of property.
Is that 41G again?
Yes, 41G. I'm not aware of a DEA procedure specifically. Mm-hmm. And they could not, we would assert, sue under the FTCA because, as we've laid out here, these were detained under the detained goods exception, so Congress has not waived its sovereign immunity to this. But to back up and to the discussion you had with opposing counsel, as she correctly stated, analogs are substances that have a substantial similarity in chemical structure or pharmacological effect to listed goods, and those are treated the same as listed controlled substances. And so even before the DEA listed these products were illegal. And even now, the Department of Justice is prosecuting individuals who have trafficked in UR-144 XRL-11 even during that period before they were listed. The DOJ prosecutes analog cases. Congress adopted it precisely because it's difficult to keep up with what chemists may devise in trying to stay one step ahead of law enforcement officials. And to my knowledge, there have been at least three juries that have rendered guilty verdicts finding that these substances are analogs. And I'm not aware of any juries that have acquitted on the analog issue. I'd be happy to submit an additional filing to the court identifying those cases if it wished. And so I think it's really important to set aside the claim by the smoke shop that these were lawful goods or that these are legal substances. They were not. Judge Randa's statement was not a finding. It was not a holding. It was certainly just dicta. His holding on the Rule 41 motion was that the property could not be returned because it was listed. In making his comment that there was not a substantial similarity in chemical structure, he did not cite or discuss any scientific literature or expert opinion. In other district court cases that have been presented with this issue and have been cited to Judge Randa's decision have not followed it, noting that, again, he didn't cite any particular scientific findings. Other cases, and I would cite to the court the Fadida decision at 942 F. 2nd, 1270, had said that there is a substantial similarity in chemical structure. And again, if the court wished, I'd be happy to submit that issue in writing. But I really think it's sort of a side issue, because the question here is not whether the substances were lawful. The question is whether suit may be brought forth under the detained goods exception. And again, Congress wanted to shield core law enforcement activity from the threat of tort suits. And that's this case falls squarely in the heart of that.
So the difference between something that's seized for investigative purposes and something that's seized solely for forfeiture, that's something that both sides have been discussing in the briefs. What's an example of something that's seized just for forfeiture?
I think I'm glad you asked that question, because I think it's really helpful to think about what is the paradigm case of a seizure for the purpose of forfeiture. Throughout federal forfeiture laws, there are provisions that allow for the application to receive a seizure warrant to go seize property specifically to pursue forfeiture. And that happens all the time. Law enforcement officers obtain a seizure warrant to go after, say, a bank account that has proceeds of criminal activity or a vehicle that was purchased from the proceeds of criminal activity. And in those cases, you can see both by how the seizure occurred. It occurred through a mechanism specifically designed for forfeiture. And you can tell by the nature of what's being seized that it wasn't seized for its evidentiary value, but because it was subject to forfeiture, and that was the reason for it. In contrast to situations like this one, or those confronted by this court in Pearson or Foster or any of the judicial opinions to address this issue, they have unanimously said that if you have a seizure in the context of an investigative process, that does not come within CAFRA Section 3. And that follows from the text of Section 3, which speaks to property seized for the purpose of forfeiture. And more than that, I think it follows from the structure. I laid out the importance of thinking about the detained goods exception broadly, because it forms the backdrop against which Section 3 should be construed. And if the court were to follow the smoke shop's position, then a wide array of seizures that are done in investigative contexts may then be subject to tort suits because, as Your Honor's question implies, often things that are seized in investigative processes may also be subject to forfeiture. Perhaps they were property that facilitated a crime, perhaps they're potential contraband. And so if all of those seizures are potentially the subject of tort suits, the detained goods exception will be eviscerated. That's what Foster noted. And I think that's a very strong reason to adopt the sole purpose test. In contrast, I have not heard yet from the smoke shop what test it is proposing to distinguish between seizures that would fall within CAFRA Section 3 and those that are blocked by the detained goods exception. I think that question should be put exactly to opposing counsel, because I don't think they've suggested an administrable test yet.
Position is we should adopt the Ninth Circuit test.
I agree. I think that the court should say that if a seizure had investigative purposes, it falls outside of CAFRA Section 3. The there was some discussion of the timing of events here, and opposing counsel suggested that, I guess the position is that this was a seizure solely for forfeiture. I suppose that's their position, or that it was deemed immediately forfeited. And that simply is not borne out by the facts. And I think Your Honor's questions teased that out when you asked, at the time that they went to the shop, they stated the agent said what they were going to do was test the products. And that reflects they did not know whether they contained controlled substances or had ingredients that were controlled substance analogs. And I think it's very important to keep the timing in mind here. The seizure was in September 2012, and again, at that time, they stated their purpose was to investigate. That occurred in the course of a criminal investigation. I would direct the court's attention to docket entry number 11. That's the government's response to the Rule 41G filing. And in that, you'll see the government describes the criminal investigation. It attaches police reports. It attaches testing done by the DEA even before the seizure, because again, this was an ongoing criminal investigation. There were concerns that the smoke shop was trafficking in controlled substances. That's the context of the seizure and investigation. And it's borne out by what follows. Even by December of 2012, that letter that opposing counsel cited to the court, I think actually supports our position. As she noted, it's at page, I believe, 33 of the appendix. And what the government says in response, and it's an initial response to the motion for the return of property, was that it had test results back that only reflected about half of the seized products. As to the other half, testing results were not back yet, and it reserved judgment. It was not asserting that those products were contraband, let alone that they were forfeited. This reflects the investigative nature of what was going on here. Opposing counsel puts a lot of emphasis on a statement by a DE agent in October 16th of 2012. I don't think that statement gets a smoke shop to a seizure for the sole purpose of forfeiture. First of all, again, it happened over a month after the seizure, so it's not particularly probative of what the purpose of the seizure was a month earlier. Second, it was a statement made by a single DE agent who had not even participated in the seizure, and you can see that fact is also found in the appendix at, I believe, page 11. And so you have a single agent who makes this statement. I don't think that can be used to determine the government's position, particularly when a few months later in December you see in a court filing the government reflecting its reserved judgment as to property that had not yet been tested. And then even as to the statement itself, it's rather ambiguous. The fullest recounting of it is at page 20 of the appendix. And what the agent says is, you will not receive the property back even if it doesn't have controlled substances. That was before any test results had come back. And it may well have simply been a prediction that even if there weren't controlled substances, there may be analogs, and that might be the reason why the property isn't returned. Or he makes reference to the FDA. Perhaps the agent thought that the goods would be investigated for misbranding violations, which is within the FDA's ambit. But again, even if you thought that reflected that in some part there was a forfeiture motive to the seizure, you cannot come to the conclusion that there was not also, at least in part, if not principally, an investigative purpose to the seizure. And that's what necessarily brings this case outside of CAFA Section 3. As of the point when the DEA did list these substances, I think even opposing counsel would agree that at that point they did become contraband and therefore were subject to the 21 U.S.C. 881 summary forfeiture provisions. And in fact, that's been the smoke shop's theory that it didn't cite in its complaint. In its complaint, it said no forfeiture proceedings have been initiated. The complaint doesn't cite any forfeiture law. But now on appeal, they're hanging their hat on 881. And it strikes me that to the extent that that's true, and to the extent that now it has been listed, they're actually barred by another provision of CAFRA Section 3. Subsection 2 says that suits cannot proceed if the interest of the property owner is forfeited. And we didn't necessarily make this point in our briefs, but the point shows how much of a misfit this claim is with CAFRA Section 3. It was intended for situations, and this is clear from the legislative history we cited, that it's intended for situations where the property owner prevails in a forfeiture action, gets back its property to find that it was damaged, or it finds out that the law enforcement officers lost its property. And that is far from what's going on here. And in fact, as we found out, their interest has been forfeited. So that's, in fact, a separate ground on which the court could affirm here. Just a note, counsel mentioned the DEA listing of their substance, and at times it's been suggested that it was that there was sort of a grand scheme here by the DEA agents to hold on to the property until it became listed. I don't think that's a fair reading of what happened here. The listing of the substances came out of DEA headquarters in Washington, D.C., through the Federal Register, after looking at the whole nationwide scope of trafficking in these substances. It's based on findings that are in the Federal Register we cited about the danger of these substances. It really had nothing to do with the ongoings in Delavan, Wisconsin. I would just finally like to mention that this court does have the separate ground on which to affirm here, which is a failure to exhaust. This is the requirement to file an administrative claim has been strictly enforced by this court in the Best Bearings case as well as others. And this is because this is how Congress has delineated the conditions of its waiver of sovereign immunity. There's been no claim at any point here to an administrative agency for money damages, let alone in a sum certain. So on that basis as well, the court should affirm. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Greger. Ms. Zenner. Ms. Turner.
Thank you.
And Ms. Zimmer, why don't you begin with that last point counsel made?
Yes. On that last point, the four requirements of exhausting administrative remedies are to notify the relevant agency of the incident, demand a sum certain, and the other three and four are not at issue here, that the person had title or capacity to make the claim or has the authority to represent the claimant. But here, the motion for return of property, including David Yarmo's declaration, the owner attached to that motion, set out in clear detail everything surrounding the seizure.
But did it set out a sum certain?
It did. If you look at the appendix on page 20 of his declaration, I believe it's paragraph 7 of his declaration, he itemizes every product taken by the government, the units of each of those products, and the specific amount of money that they value that product at, and it comes to a specific total actually of about $112,000 down to the change, if you see that on appendix page 20. I'm uncertain what more Mr. Yarmo or the spokeshop could have informed the government in terms of a sum certain here. And the purpose of the exhaustion requirement was met by clearly stating all of the facts around this and the sum certain that the government would require to investigate the claim and consider settlement negotiations of that claim. there's nothing that indicates a specific form filed with the agency again would have done more than that, and I think for that reason the spirit of the law and the purpose of that was executed here.
Mr. Turner, your focus of course is on forfeiture here. Do you have a position on whether or not we should adopt the Foster test of the Ninth Circuit?
I do. I think this is an odd case. If you look at all the cases on this, they always involve someone's being arrested or a search warrant is executed, which specifies the illicit conduct being investigated, or it's a prisoner already in custody who had his property detained and harmed, or there's an indictment. None of that's here. Again, this is when the officers came to the smoke shop and first gained consent to test the property, and then that consent was withdrawn. And in this circumstance first, I think the Ninth Circuit's sole purpose for forfeiture should not be applied. it should be considered here as one of the main purposes. But if it is applied, I think Foster should still not bar the smoke shop's claim here in light of the fact that despite the DEA's position, the evidence was that this was legal product at the time that it was seized. And the fact that the government deemed it, the DEA said that it was analogs first and contraband and then outright made it illegal, should not bar the smoke shop's claims, again, in the interest of due process here. The actions of the government throughout this have foreclosed every remedy of the smoke shop, and I think it's a serious concern that should be considered by this government, by this court, and not deemed waived or ignored in this circumstance.
Let me go back to that 41G petition. There was no indication that a civil tort claim for money damages that it included that.
In the motion for return of property, it did not explicitly say we seek to have this money returned, because at that time, smoke shop was certain and was borne out by the evidence that this is legal property. I will say that the government did not learn of, first off, we think it was sufficient to put the government on notice that this would be coming if the property was not returned. But in addition, if I may finish my thought, before the amended complaint was filed in May, when the smoke shop became aware of the DEA's notice of intent to schedule these drugs, the smoke shop submitted a supplemental brief to the court that said explicitly that if the smoke shop intends to move to amend and seek money damages for a conversion claim of $120,000, if these are in fact deemed scheduled, so that the efforts here would not be mooted by that action.
That's it?
Thank you. Yes.
Right. Thank you, Ms. Erner. Thank you, Ms. Krieger. Case is taken under advisement.